This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
And here we go. So this class really is the constructing of theology of exile. We'll talk a little bit about exclusivity, and that wasn't my word. Actually, it should be exclusivity and entirety. But first of all, I need to erase this. Second of all, we need to talk about these two words, right? One of my favorite games to play as a teacher is called disambiguation. You guys ever play that game? Anybody ever use Wikipedia?
Yeah,
right? If you use Wikipedia and you type in a word like I was doing yesterday, you know, John the Second. So John the Second could be a lot of people,
yeah.
Right? And so it asks you to disambiguate, which is a fancy way of saying, well, tell me exactly what you're talking about, right? One of the great problems of all communication is what we call the problem of the signifier and the signified, right? A simple example of if I said tree, so everybody knows what a tree is, right? Except I'm willing to bet, depending on where we grew up and what our personal associations are, et cetera, we're all picturing something different. Now, when it comes to tree, it's not like such a big deal if I'm picturing a big oak tree and you're picturing, I don't know, a dogwood or whatever. Like, okay, fine. But what if I said God? Now, the funny thing about language is that the more meaning-laden a word is, the less likely it is that two people will share the same meaning. Right? So, because if I've done my homework and thought about it, then when I use the word God, I'm being precise or deliberately ambiguous, depending. Right? And if you've done your homework and thought about it, then when you hear the word God, you know what you mean. But the odds that we are talking about the same thing are very slim. And this is the source of the breakdown in so much communication and relationship, is that I know exactly what I'm talking about.
Can you redefine the title of this section?
Title of this section of this class?
Yes.
Theology of Exile. I mean, I just, constructing a theology of exile.
Exclusivity and...
Oh, I said it's probably exclusivity and entirety was probably a better word. I didn't choose that tagline there. But why am I saying this? Because this is how you can have a conversation where I know exactly what I'm saying, and you think you know exactly what you're hearing, but we're talking about two entirely different things. This is all life, but you know, marriage is where it becomes most stark, because there is a way to solve this problem, and that problem is that we have to be in constant, intimate relationship. You know, words aren't little boxes that I can put meaning into and hand it to you, and you open up, and there you go. Words are points of contact in a whole network of meaning. And if we share, we're speaking the same language, so to speak, in a metaphorical sense, right? Then when I use words like God, love, country, mom, apple pie, and all that stuff, so then we're actually having a conversation. So therefore, a lot of constructing a theology of exile is going to be about creating the tools to have a conversation that still makes sense. Right? What do I mean? Is that if you read the Torah, there's a fairly linear narrative. Right? Starts where? In the beginning. Right? It's where every good story starts, right? Except for my brother, who's actually an author, who tells me it's better to start at the end. It's more interesting. But it starts in the beginning. You got this whole narrative of interpersonal relationships that takes up most of the book of Genesis. Then you got this family that goes down into Egypt, and they have their experience there, and we come out of Egypt, and out of Egypt, we're on our way to the land of Israel, little pit stop for 40 years in the desert. Into Israel, the Tanakh continues, relatively speaking, in a linear fashion, right? We come together from tribes to kingship, the kings, the two kingdoms, right? Eventually, the temple is built, and then it's destroyed, and then what happens? Big break. Big discontinuity. And it's not so clear whether the conversation is going to continue, because what holds the conversation in the most of the Tanakh is the geographic boundaries. The people of Israel are the people who live in Israel. Right? As we pointed out in the last class, when Ruth, the most famous convert, converts, so to speak, she says, I'll go where you go. Your people will be my people. And only then does she say, your God will be my God. Theology is very low on her list of identity. The primary definition of identity at that point was geographic. Right, is this air conditioner off, or is that my imagination? It's making noise, but it seems very hot in here.
I turned it to 25.
Oh.
Between 20 and 25,
maybe better for you. I mean, people, okay, I'm fine. I'm just concerned.
Lower?
Yeah, it's
20's too cold.
It was on 20? Yeah, it was chilly in here last time. All right, we'll see what this does. Please let me know. I don't want anybody suffering, either by too cold or too warm.
Right.
Okay, so the question that we're going to engage in this class is, how did the Jews of their day deal with this discontinuity? I mean, what might have been a natural response to the destruction of the temple and the exile from the land? Yeah, that's it. I mean, the Torah doesn't really, I mean, it hints at it in the book of Deuteronomy, right, about what will you'll go away and you'll come back. By the way, the biblical critics will tell you, when was Deuteronomy written? A lot of it post-exilic, right? Meaning, so depending on the way you relate to the text, that may or may not help be helpful to us. But either way, the simple narrative of the Torah just doesn't seem to be going that way. And so therefore, there's a deep question. Why not then say, give up? Anybody really familiar with the prophets? There is a place in the prophets where the Jewish people actually say this. Anybody know where it is? In the book of Ezekiel, they come to Ezekiel, who's in Bavel, and they say, that's it. We're going to be like the peoples around us. I mean, it was a fairly reasonable assumption. We blew it, destroyed the temple. Remember, God as an abstraction was not so commonly held in their world. God was there's a blood God land idea. Like, where you are is very deeply related to your ability to worship your God. And what does Ezekiel say to them? In the voice of God, of course. No way! This story's not over. And the question is, what has to transform in order for the people to be able to imagine that there is actually a continuity which can bridge this great discontinuity? Do you understand what I'm saying? Because this is the sort of critical piece we want to think about. And of course, the same holds true for our day.
This had never happened before.
It had never happened before.
This is, we were the first that ever actually exiled from our land and came back. And well, the Buddhists, or I guess they're hoping that the Tibetans are hoping that they can pull that off.
Right.
But we're the only ones who ever pulled it off.
So now you're talking about on this end, because the parallel, and it's always worth it at this stage in the seminar to think about these two parallels. So today we're looking at the problem in reverse. For 2,000 years, we've built a very, I don't want to say comfortable, but at least strong identity in exile. The last couple hundred, it's kind of fragmented, but it's pretty rich and kicking alive. I'm happy with it, right? And then suddenly, it's like, well, what does it actually mean now that we're back in the land? First temple we're talking?
Second.
Sorry. Okay.
And you are still God-fearing.
Mm-hmm.
Christianity seems a pretty logical transfer. Look.
Absolutely.
Look at the temple.
It's gone.
He's transferred the Brit.
Yep. And many Jews indeed went that way. You know, without getting too far into history, but there was a whole group of Jews that were known as Hellenistic Judaism, which served as the fertile ground for Christianity for largely that reason. But you know what the difference between the first temple destruction and the second temple destruction was? By the second temple destruction, it had happened already. Not that it was easy or clean or simple, but on some level, there was a model we could say, okay, wait, we've been here before, right? When the first temple was destroyed and the Babylonian exile came, even though it was only 70 years long, so in theory, as the book of Ezra says, there were people who remembered the first temple when they saw the early second temple. Nevertheless, it had never happened before. And so therefore, there was a challenge that had to be engaged. So this is what I want to do today. We're going to start with the text. You guys have the source book in front of you. And the first text, I'm hoping, is familiar to many people. It's the opening of Pirkei Avot, of the Ethics of Our Fathers. Is that noise coming from the Beit Midrash? I don't think so. No? No, it's somebody on a loudspeaker. It may be. It's coming from outside? Okay, then there's nothing I can do about it. Not that I would have gone to the Beit Midrash anyway, I guess. So what are we looking at here? This is the opening mishnah of what's called the Ethics of Our Fathers, Pirkei Avot. I'm hoping people are familiar with it. Moshe received the Torah from Sinai, transmitted to the Joshua, Joshua to the elders, elders to the prophets, prophets to the transmitted to the men of the great assembly. And they said three things, which we'll talk about in a second. First of all, let's locate ourselves. How would you characterize this? What is this Mishnah coming to teach me? Yeah?
Well, basically, you could call it the Jewish apostolic succession.
Right. It's a chain of attribution. Unbroken? Some sort of. It's a little bit fishy. By the way, here's a $64,000 question. What's missing from this chain? Well, the judges, the rabbis lump into the elders. There's a very glaring one that the Torah gives a lot of time to that doesn't seem to appear here. The priests. Now, because we're interested in Torah here, so the kings, it's natural there. The Torah says that the priests, the Siftei Kohen, right, that's where you go to the priest and ask for knowledge.
So this wasn't written by the rabbis.
Well, you know, the rabbis were not so fond of the priests as a caste. In fact, one of the arguments is that they wrote the priests out. Yep.
Wouldn't there be another point that factors that the temple was, at this point, the temple is gone?
At which point?
At the point of Pirkei Avot.
We mean when the Mishnah is written. Yeah. From just point of historical fact, if people aren't aware, the Mishnah is compiled in mid to late 2nd century of the Common Era. So even the second temple has been destroyed for 150 years. Yeah.
So we're building something new here, and the Kohanim are not a part of it.
Right. That might be practically speaking. There's also some ideological conflict going on in there.
But the Sanhedrin has basically the same authority as Moses.
Sanhedrin being the high court. Right. Ah. So that's who I want to focus on in the men of the great assembly. Who were they? What role they played in shaping who we are today? But first, I just want to be clear: what's being handed on here?
Authority.
Why do you say that?
Just like God gave the right to Moses, an unbroken chain, what the men of the great assembly decide, he is the answer. There is no booking much discussion.
And what's your textual proof that what we're talking about here is authority? I happen to agree with you, but I want you in the text. Look at the text for a second.
It's basically saying that the oral law, which, in this case, is actually the top of the oral law, not the written law, but, you know, the written law is already written, but the oral law went, you know, just like Moses passed to Yeshua, that whole smicha was unbroken. There was, you know, it was more than just knowledge. It was actually
authority to wield it.
Authority to wield it.
So the key word in the text is judgment. I'm going to tell you how to behave.
Right. Well, before we get to the content, you know what's amazing? I think the proof that this is about authority is the lack of any content up until the very end. What? Moshe receives the Torah. Okay. We don't really know what we're talking about there. And he handed it to Joshua. Joshua, we don't know what they did. It's only when we get to the men of the great assembly that we actually get content. This is the fundamental shift that's being shown to us here.
It's a complete assumption that this is the way it is. No other discussion.
Yeah, and historically speaking, this idea that there was an oral Torah that was parallel to the written Torah in its authority and legitimacy appears when in Jewish history? People know when its first appearances are? Yeah, that's fair enough. So I'd say 2nd century BCE. It really is like one of the hot topics of argument that surrounds the Maccabean era. It really predates the Maccabees by a little bit, but not much. Now the question is before that, did everybody assume that was true and you didn't need to talk about it? Like in the same way that we don't need to talk about, in America at least, whether democracy is a legitimate form of government. It just, that's the way we live. Or was it? Right. I mean, the Karaites will tell you a very different story, by the way, if you ask them about this Mishnah.
Presumably there were multiple strands of tradition, and then the rabbis decided on what was the right strand, and then that became the official version of the Oral Torah.
Right. So are we seeing here a foundation myth? Meaning, remember, this Mishnah is compiled in the 2nd century of the Common Era. From the historical evidence we have, the idea of an oral law was, let's say, 400 to 500 years older than that. And the rabbis of the Mishnah were a very small group of the Jews. Within 300 years, however, after the Mishnah, this became who the Jews were. So we could take a few perspectives on that. I don't want to go off track too much, but I want you to understand that what we're seeing in this Mishnah is a midpoint of a process of gaining exclusivity. Meaning what? That we have exclusive rights to tell the story. Right? Which are bound up in things like legitimacy and authenticity. But who are the Jews? Now we're talking 12th century Spain. 11th. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. By then, even earlier, the Karaites were the majority here. They were the majority in the land of Israel. They were the majority in Egypt. Absolutely. In terms of absolute numbers, it could be even higher than
30%. So that means there wasn't So
if you want a full discussion, at the risk of a shameless plug, I would encourage you to listen to my podcast on the Gaonic period. What happened was, listen, ism and schism come into the world together. It's an important thing to remember. Anytime you can claim an ism. Here's Judaism. So what used to be heterodoxy becomes heresy. Right? If there's no Judaism, we're all just Jews and we have different ways of doing it. So then we just have different ways of doing it. As soon as I stand up and say, no, this is what it is. Well, you become a heretic. Instead of just being another type of Jew. So the Gaonic period is really the end of the process of establishing the sole legitimacy of rabbinic Judaism. And lo and behold, the Karaite schism, which is not what they call it, right? The Karaite schism pops up. Because ism and schism will always come into the world together. You're absolutely right. Right? Nevertheless, the Karaites have a tough sell at this point in history at being the legitimate sort of inheritors of the Jewish tradition. You can speak to them about that. I'll let them tell their own story. So this Mishnah, aside from the questions of authority and the chain of attribution, gives us three statements. Now, without focusing on the content per se, be deliberate in judgment, raise up many disciples, and make a fence for the Torah. What was the profession of the people that this was said to? Be deliberate in judgment, raise up many disciples or students, and make a fence around the Torah. Well, that's not really a profession except in today. Meaning, and even then, by the way, I can tell you it's a sketchy one at best. Judges, for sure, be deliberate in judgment. What else?
Teachers.
It's very important. You know, what's the relationship between teachers and judges? And here, there's a critical piece, in this development of a theology of exile, by which we mean, how do we relate to a world which has presented us with a deep discontinuity in bridging it? Right? So there's two reasons you would go to a judge. One is a particular judge. Imagine you had a choice. You had a case, you went to an arbitration. Make it easy. You want to find someone to arbitrate your dispute. How do you choose the person you choose?
Reputation.
What?
Get the judgment you want.
Get the judgment you want. Meaning you actually know what they think and assume either by reputation or you know by personal experience that they're going to go without the cynical getting the judgment wanted, that they're actually going to do it right. Also, by the way, your students would be the best way to do that. The other reason you might go to a judge is because you have no choice, right? For sure. If not in your favor, then at least it's going to understand who you are and what you're after in life. You know what the difference, you guys, POSEC is like a halachic decisor, if people aren't familiar with the terms. The difference between a halachic decisor and everybody else is not their knowledge. Not in my experience. Although, it's a necessary precursor. You know what the difference between a halachic decisor and a really smart person is? People listen to their answers. And people ask them questions in the first place. You could be the greatest wise person of all time. And if people don't ask you questions, or when they do, they don't listen to your answers, you're just some wise guy, right? You're not actually shaping things. And what we're seeing here is, well, I'll ask in reverse. Moshe Joshua, the elders, the prophets, they all belong to a world in which legitimacy of authority was rooted in the divine. Right? When Moshe stood up and said, this is what we're going to do, even though people argue with him the whole time, his basis for saying it was, and God told me so. Right? And ditto Joshua, and ditto the elders, and certainly the prophets, hence the title. And the men of the great assembly, when they stood up and said, we're going to do this, why were people going to listen? Why do you listen to wise people? And why would you think they're going to lead you in the direction that's good? Because you think they're wise. Right? Meaning, this is a shift from an authority based in revelation to an authority based in education. Right? Wisdom has to prove itself. It doesn't matter if somebody stands up and starts doing miracles and showing signs and wonders. If when they open their mouth, they tell you something totally foolish, you're going to say, this person is not wise. Now, you may go back to the old model and say, but they proved to me that God said so, so therefore I'm going to listen to them. And we see this again and again in the world. People actually more or less want proof and are not always interested in wisdom. Because ultimately, and here's the real kicker about the theology of exile, who is the ultimate decisor of what's wise? The teacher or the student? Yeah. Because it's always the students.
Again, they choose the wise people that they want. I'm one of these sad people that choose a new refrigerator based on the consumer guide rather than what my rabbi tells me.
You vote with your feet.
You know, these days, and I don't know if it's like that then, deciding you're going to go to an authority figure to ask your question is the price of admission to be part of the community.
Yeah.
You may or may not think they're wise. You may or may not think they actually represent an unbroken line to Moshe at Sinai, but that's the way the game is played, is you have to buy into the system.
So you're adding another layer, which is beyond some theoretical discussion of the basis of authority. There's a real world consideration of community, which is, I think you're a fool, but if this is the only game in town and you're in charge, so, well, at some point I'm going to accept it. So one second, and then let's embed this in history. Who were these people of the Great Assembly? Where are we in history now? Just like a brief window. You guys have been looking a lot at the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. I'll get you, I won't forget. Oh, my mic came on. Oh, thank you. That's a very practical consideration. I appreciate it. Sorry, people. Where are we in history? If you guys have been looking at the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, you will discover in the 10th chapter of Nehemiah something which is called Brit Amanah, a faithful covenant. You can look if you want. It really amounts to like a list of a lot of people's names. You don't need to look at it right now, but if we're going to speak about the men of the Knesset, Anshei Knesset Gedolah, the men of the Great Assembly, then we're going to look there for its beginning. How many people were there in the men of the Great Assembly, according to the Gemara? Anybody know? No, that's the Sanhedrin. That's the Jewish High Court. There were 120. Interesting, how many people are there in the Parliament of Israel, which is, of course, called the Knesset? It's 120. That's where the number comes from. The reason the Knesset of Israel is both called the Knesset and has 120 people is because the early Zionists, when they looked for their parliamentary model in their tradition, looked back to the men of the Great Assembly and not to the Sanhedrin, which is a discussion unto itself. Okay, and where were they? Most understandings, even traditional understanding, much less the sort of historical critical understanding, is that this was not a group of 120 people who sat in a room all at once, that this was a process that began with Nehemiah and ends, if you are familiar with the next Mishnah in this series, which I didn't bring you, with Shimon HaTzadik, Simon the Righteous, was amongst the remnants of the Great Assembly, is what it says. And he had his own things to say. We're not going to go into it now. So we're going to put him basically at the encounter with the Greeks. Alexander on the roadside. Excellent. Yeah. So historically, culturally, we are placing this body of people between the return from the Babylonian exile and the encounter with Greek culture. And they are going to do a number of things, and that's what we're going to look at in our learning today. They're going to, first of all, shift that model, which I hope you're able to see in this Mishnah, from the source of authority being divine revelation to an educational model of authority. You raise up many students, and there you're going to become an automatic authority figure. When I get emails or phone calls, I wouldn't say every day, but a few times a week, from people who want my insight on halachic or otherwise matters. Why? Did they pick me out of the yellow pages? Have they listened to my podcast? For sure not. Well, a couple of them. But no, most of them were my students who I have a personal relationship with, who I've demonstrated through learning together that they care about what I have to say. And in the marketplace, unlike the communal issue, in the marketplace of today, if they didn't think what I had to say mattered, they wouldn't call. Right? In a metaphorical sense, yes.
Over many centuries, which started somewhere after Nehemiah and ended...
Right before the encounter with the Greeks.
Which they encountered like 300, like with Alexander the Great?
Yeah. Now again, this is why...
Only 150
years. 150 years or so. Right? And it is, interestingly enough, by the way, the word Sanhedrin, just to give you guys the full historical picture, the first reference we have to the Sanhedrin is... Which way Antiochus? It was Antiochus III, where Josephus, and there's another document which is evading me what it is right now, record that the Jewish leaders, the Sanhedrin, which is a Greek word, right, came and negotiated a deal with Antiochus III, who was the head of the Seleucid Empire at his time. Before that, the word Sanhedrin does not exist, and there's a big debate in terms of where the institution has its origins. Right, so that's where we are in history. And now what I want to let you guys do in your learning is to figure out what it was that they actually did. Right, questions or comments before I just let you go with this introduction?
You mentioned about how something is accepted. Even some of the measures enacted by Ezra did not become halakha because just people couldn't do it.
Yes, it's an important thing to keep in mind that it's not just a historical process, but it is a legal, legitimate principle that declarations made by leadership that fail to spread lack legitimacy. Okay, so what are you looking at here and what's our goal? So looking at the source sheet, the second source is this, let's say somewhat wacky, actually the second and third, are a series of somewhat wacky Gemaras on our time period. So when you're reading them, I want you to identify what did the leadership of its day see as the primary challenges and what were their solutions. That's in source 2. Source 3, which asks directly the question, why were they called the men of the great assembly? There should make your focus on how are they engaging the absence of God as a positive event. Right? The Bible is filled with God. In the rabbinic literature, God as a character is quite removed. So that's source 3. Source 4 and... so 4, 5, and 6 altogether have to do with the specific role of prayer. Now, aside from just seeing what role did the men of the Great Assembly play in prayer, you also want to ask what role prayer plays in identity. Right? And the last piece is why does the language of prayer matter? Both in terms of Hebrew versus other languages, and in terms of the specificity of the liturgy, something which I know many people struggle with. So your answer might be, by the way, it's perfectly legitimate to say it doesn't, and this was a mistake. That's fine. But then just tell me why you think so, or tell each other. Right? Meaning I'm not trying to prejudice your thoughts with a leading question. It's totally fine to say this is completely wrong. Great. Then tell me why you think so. That's the only requirement. Is that clear what the goal is here? And again, the overarching goal is understanding how did they build structures to bridge this gap of, it looks like the Torah and Tanakh is all hunky-dory, God, Israel, going off into the sunset together, and then suddenly exile comes, boom, everything breaks down. How is, after exile, this a successful attempt to rebuild theology just being the understanding of how God and creation interact? Questions, comments, before we launch into the learning? Okay, great. Let's take, right now it's 11:45. We have until 1:10. So let's take a good 40, 45 minutes, and we'll come back together for the last 30, 40 minutes. I'm not going anywhere. I'm right here. So if people have questions or comments, happy to hear it. Okay, let's try that again. How'd it go? Okay, what did you see? Remember, our goal here is I made an assertion that there's a huge discontinuity between the First Temple period and the return that we call exile. And furthermore, we didn't say it, but I just want to make it clear that theology are humanity's thoughts on God. Right? Thinking about God. The Torah is not a work of theology. The Torah is God's thoughts on man. It is, in fact, in many ways, the opposite of theology, which is often missed because we're used to putting it into a theological package. But it solves a lot of the questions in terms of, you know, people say, why would God care whether one ox gored another? You know what the answer is? People care whether one ox gored another. Okay, so in light of our attempt to build a theology, ways to think about God in light of that discontinuity, what did you see in the first? We'll just go straight through. This first, hey, anybody find this? First, Agatha wacky. Yeah? Poetic. And what did you see there? What moved you if we're talking poetry? Yes, it's a very strange, in mythic language, it begs the question of what's going on, yeah?
But indeed, the evil inclination, but it has to be controlled.
So there's definitely...
The touching of the eyes is always one way of restricting the activity of the evil inclination. That's the way of controlling. Without the evil inclination, you can't live.
Well, hang on, there's two inclinations. You're talking about the second one, right? The evil inclination for sexuality... The rabbis thought, well, we succeeded in the first run. Let's, right?
But there is an evil inclination for rivalry. There's an earlier evil inclination that has to do with people worship or man's relationship to God.
Right. Let's go through piece by piece. Where does this Agadita start? Anybody look at this line in Nehemiah? Great. What was happening there? No, we're talking about the first line here, Nehemiah 9:4. And they cried aloud with a loud voice to the Lord God.
The temple was destroyed.
Uh-huh.
It was destroyed because of the evil inclination. So we want to get rid of the evil inclination.
Think simpler. What is this ninth parak of Nehemiah doing? What's it doing? Did you guys look, just scan the parak?
Describing the people standing there.
That's the opening. But what? I'm sorry, I don't know your name. Just about to speak that we spoke in Hebrew before. It gives them what? A history. Historia. It's a fascinating, by the way, the ninth chapter in Nehemiah is worth spending time with. It actually makes its way into our liturgy in a few places, right? But it's fascinating. Nehemiah tells them this whole story. And then the Gemara comes up with this sort of expansion of the story specifically about our failures. But why does it matter that Nehemiah is telling this story? He's about to give them a hard time, right? And Nehemiah is repeating a pattern which we can see throughout the Tanakh. First, I'll tell you where you went wrong, and then I'll tell you what you ought to do. You know who the first person to do that was? Moses, the whole book of Deuteronomy. The whole book of Deuteronomy is Moses saying, and this time you blew it, and that time you blew it. And who follows Moses?
Joshua,
excellent. In the 24th parak of Joshua, it's called Ma'amad Shechem. Joshua stands up and does the same thing. I can give you a review of your history of how far you've blown it, right? You know who the next person to do it is? Shmuel. He does the exact same thing. And here Nehemiah is repeating, once you have a phenomenon like this four times in the Tanakh, it's worth it to consider what exactly is going on here. And I want to show you something which I believe is happening, right? Here we have a chart, people, God, and the question is, How close do the people periodically come to God? Whoop, there we go. Oh, what? You can look at Jewish history this way. There are points in which we as a people come close to God, there are points in which we fall away. You know, one of the advantages, Sefer Shoftim is like a compressed version of this whole cycle. Excellent. Right? And there we see very clearly that our physical security as a people is dependent upon that closeness. So one of the challenges that this gap of exile presents to us is the disappearance of prophecy. We've spoken in various places, those of us who have been learning together for the last couple of days, about the fact that the last three prophets, Haggai, Malachi, and Zechariah, are the beginning of the Second Temple period. And this popped up in our sources a few places here. Up until now, if the people wanted to know if they were on the right track or not, who told them? The prophets. You know, that's what they do, even though we weren't listening, apparently. Stand on the street corner, woe is he, you know, so at least you know whether you're on track or not. When prophecy disappears, how will we know? And what does it have to do with history? I'm going to tell you, there's a process that I call mishpat. Right? And you can see it in the book of Shmuel in particular, that he calls it mishpat, I didn't make it up, which is making a judgment. Anybody ever do any overland travel without a map? Right? There's a tool you can use to know whether you're headed in the right direction, which is called backsighting. Right? Meaning what? I don't know where I'm headed necessarily, but I know where I've been. And hopefully I know where I am. And if I can figure out where I am and I can look back where I was, I can draw a line between those two points and it will tell me where I'm headed. This process is the exact same. If I look back over history, I say, listen, I can find the points where we were close to God, or the opposite, find the points where we were away from, then I should have an idea of the line that's going to keep me on that track. That's what's happening in Nehemiah here. Now, the sages are at a particular place. Where are they? Up or down here? Well, it's tough. They're kind of here. Why? Because on one hand, the exile, destruction of the first temple, disaster. On the other hand, they are coming back. I mean, remember, Ezra says, by the word of the Lord through the mouth of Jeremiah, hallelujah, here we are. So they're in between. What they want to do, though, is figure out what? How do we stay here? And they have identified the primary enemy. What's the primary enemy at the beginning of this? For which? For idolatry. Remember, we'll talk a little bit about the sexual desire there, but that's an afterthought. They say, ooh, hey, that went well. Let's double down. So now here's the thing. What is the desire for idolatry? What is that? It's a hard thing for us to imagine today. I mean, do we really think idolatry is about, oh, I'm not worthy, like this is my God? Well, it might be.
The evil inclination, all the things that lead you to a place that takes you further away from God.
All the things that lead you to a place that's...
Whether it's sexual immorality, whether it's idolatry, I mean, there's a number of those are the biggies.
So here's the challenge. I tend to agree with you. Here's the challenge. Where was the desire for idolatry located? And here's where your mythic language becomes very important. Where? In the Kodesh Kodeshim, in the Holy of Holies. So if the desire for idolatry is really a code word for everything that takes us away from God, wait a minute. How come all the stuff that takes us away from God was actually right there in the middle? What do you guys think about that? People discuss that in your Chavruta?
Mm-hmm. I would argue that at least the desire for idolatry was first manifested in so far as Jewish history goes in the matter of the Golden Calf.
And so therefore it would be in the Holy of Holies because... Wait. I think I want to follow. You're making an excellent point. Which is there's a root of the desire for idolatry, which isn't actually necessarily about taking me away from God. It's actually about having something I can point to and say, there is God, like the golden calf.
Right.
Here, Elo Elokecha Yisrael, here are your gods, Israel, that brought you out of Egypt.
Right.
So therefore, the desire for idolatry would be located in the Holy of Holies because...
Well, I think
and not on God.
And the search for a higher authority is good.
Mm-hmm.
You have to get it right.
Ah.
And idolatry is getting it wrong.
Right. Meaning it's the same instinct. One is success and one is failure. Is that what you're going to say? Yeah, there's a very, and I want to bring your comments together. First of all, there's a trap that lies right at the center of the Holy of Holies. I don't know how much time you guys spend about thinking about the temple, right? But there is a trap. God has a house. I mean, it's downright idolatrous. Anybody ever get uncomfortable when they see people standing up in front of a Sefer Torah or kissing it as it goes by? Right? Something a little bit...
Kissing a mezuzah.
Kissing, something a little bit funny in that. At the same time, people have a deep desire for something that they can focus on. Abstractions. You know, you don't have a relationship to the abstract. And this is a deep challenge that we're going to come to when we get to the end. Furthermore, the desire for idolatry and the desire for prophecy, which is the ultimate relationship with God, are one and the same. I agree with you 100%. They are one and the same. They are a desire to transcend the self toward the higher. The difference is that idolatry allows you to take a part of yourself, externalize it, and worship it as the whole, be it the sort of ecstatic sexual side of idolatry, be it the death cult, fear, anger side of idolatry. These are things that we have within ourselves, right? And there is a powerful, by the way, if you're interested, there's an amazing book by Aldous Huxley called The Devils of Ladun, which is a long, long analysis of the human desire for transcendence. And he makes an argument there that you can just transcend upward into God. You can transcend outward. And if anybody ever done the wave at a football game, right? Which is probably the most intense experience of what it means to transcend outward. It's like part of something much larger in a very simple sense. You know, it's an incredible experience. I mean, we all laugh and always just did the wave, but there's something very powerful about 20, 30, 40,000 people doing something together, experiencing something together. And then there's the descent downward, which he identifies there into drugs and sort of sensuality. Right? Notice where our story goes in the end. Is the sages understand full well that the desire for transcendence is an intrinsic human desire. And it is a dangerous one because you don't always get it right. You don't always get it right. So you know what disappears at this point in history along with the desire for idolatry? Prophecy. You just saw them legislate prophecy out of existence. Now, does the desire for prophecy go away? Does the attempt to achieve it go away historically? Well, I can think of one person who made a good following as a prophet. What? That's even later, and for sure he did quite well. Although there now, then we call it the Messiah, so that's supposed to be the kosher prophecy. Who am I thinking of? Jesus of Nazareth. I mean, there are a billion plus people on the planet who began as believing he was a prophet and ended up thinking he was the Son of God. And that's a fairly successful attempt to claim the legitimate, I mean, without any judgment about whether he was right or not. Just look at the historical reality, meaning the sages removed this desire, apparently unsuccessfully, even though here, the work was done. And then, of course, who were the last prophets? According to the Jews? Haggai, Malachi, and Zechariah. And how do you know that's true? Because they're the last ones in the book. I mean, that's clearly a legislative decision. I mean, it doesn't mean that people didn't write things down. All you need to do is look in the Dead Sea Scrolls, right? And it doesn't mean people weren't on the street corners to claim to talk to God, like I said. Other world religions. It just means at a certain point the rabbi said, no, we're done with that. Book is closed. Right? And this is a very important subtext to what the sages are doing. They're pushing God away. They are pushing God away. They're taking the fire out of the Holy of Holies because they realize they can't handle it anymore. We don't want it or its reward. Notice what they said. It was a good thing in the first place. We blew it. By the way, what did you guys make of this whole note that fell from heaven? That makes sense to you? Like, what was that in the story? Oh, it's a lot like the argument between Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yehoshua and all his brothers. When in the end, Rabbi Eliezer says, if I'm right, let a voice come from heaven and prove that I'm right. And it does. And what do the sages say?
Well, it's not the right.
Yeah. Well, who asked you, God? Like, you're not part of this discussion any longer. You are absolutely correct. And it wasn't because the rabbis wanted all the power themselves. I believe it's because they understood full well the danger of what happened when people believed they were still in contact with God. The rabbis lived in the context of Jesus of Nazareth. He was their student, as were most of his early followers. You know, and there's a whole deep connection between Rabbi Eliezer Gadol in that story and Jesus of Nazareth, which can be explored some other time. But what fell from heaven? No, here in this story.
It's a note.
It's a note. And what's the note say? How did you understand that in this story? It's a narrative. What was this doing here?
Is that the truth is not coming from man, but that
it's a prophetic moment. It's almost like a last note. Right? And there's a very important thing you have to understand.
Depending on the chain of tradition, God's giving it to these people.
Okay, there's definitely a handoff going on there. For sure, but there's a very important piece I want to make clear here, which is secondarily important, but is a life mission for me, so I'll take your time nonetheless, right? We have to remember, and is it true across the board, be aware of the fact that we're all educated, I assume all of us, in a secular Western context. And because of that, you know, developmental psychologists will tell you that small children learn like a sponge. That's why little kids can learn multiple languages, and the rest of us, at a certain point, you won't just absorb languages anymore. You have to code and decode, right? You learn in context of what you already know. And therefore, it can be very difficult to learn anything new because you're always, consciously or not, attempting to put it into the context of what you already know. This is why I can tell you, working with many students, they have a hard time absorbing Torah when they come from particularly a university-level Western secular education, because there are some fundamentally different premises about epistemology, how you know anything, about ontology, how anything actually exists. And if you don't get at the kishkas of that, then you're not actually going to learn. So I'll give you a great example. In the Western intellectual tradition, truth is a reductionist process. What do I mean? You break something down to its smallest units of origin, and that's how you know whether it's true or not. Right, we had this discussion, those of us who learned together on Sunday in the first session, where I pointed out that Western tradition says that the facts are the origin of truth. You want to know what happened? Tell me the facts. Well, the word for truth in Hebrew is what? Right, emet. And I don't know if you've ever noticed, that's the first, middle, and last letters of the Hebrew alphabet. Right? Because truth in the mind of the Torah is actually a holistic emergent phenomenon. When do you know the truth? Not at the beginning. At the end. Chotmo shel kor bohu emet. God's seal is the truth. You put the seal on at the end of a process. Right? And this was a very important message that the sages either were giving us or were receiving, depending on if you want to read this as the mythic language or you want to read this as a real story. It matters to me not at all. Right? It's a very important difference in how you look at the world. What were they doing? They're complete, like, the whole story was about prophecy, and this is how it's going to work, and they admitted that God gave us this desire. And they decided they're going to get rid of it? You can't just change what God made. And what was the response they got? Good work. You're on track. We're heading toward the truth. And this is a very important element of the whole theology of exile we're getting at, is that the further away God gets in the mind of the sages, the closer you come to the truth. So I want to move on to the next piece in order to explore that. Yeah?
Aren't you also working hard, diligently,
yes,
to move this whole process away from the, your hands are on, you're handing a goat over you, a very physical to a more intellectual approach. And it's not just at the temple, but it's also in my own mind and how I have to fight the Yetzirah. I can't have the community limit the Yetzirah for me.
Right. Well, there's two pieces there. Did you guys hear the question? Right? Are we moving what I would call a path of abstraction? Mm-hmm. I don't have to give a goat to the angry deity anymore. I actually have to figure out what I think and how I'm going to behave, etc., for sure. At the same time, the sages were very big into the vision that the temple would be rebuilt. That'd be soon, maybe now. So, what's up with that? So, one more piece here. So, source three, Rabbi Yeshua Ben Levi asked an obvious question. Why were they so great? The men of the great assembly. Why were they so great? And what answer does he give? Reinterpretation. Great. What do you mean? Let's be specific. Which terms are they reinterpreting? I can misspell in several languages. Right. Well, they ignored great, by the way. Notice. It's very interesting because the text holds by God is great no matter what. We don't have to discuss that, apparently. So awful, awesome, and mighty. But how did they reinterpret it? First of all, let's just see what disappeared. Jeremiah came and said, foreigners are destroying your temple. Where are his awful deeds? Right? What's the link between the temple and Yirah or Norah? Right? This word Yirah, Norah in Hebrew deserves some thought. What does the word mean if you're going to translate it? Norah. Awesome. Yirah. So what's the difference between awe and fear?
Fear is when you're worried something bad is
going to
happen to you. Whereas awe is just an abstract appreciation of something out there. Not how it might impact you.
Awe is abstract?
It's not about what's going to happen to you.
It's not about what's going to happen.
It's appreciating something for its own, not for how it's going to happen.
Great. So I'll give you a visual, which for me is always helpful, and I apologize to people who might be listening to this. In my mind, fear and awe are almost the same thing. They just look like this. Fear looks like this, and awe looks like this, which is exactly what you just said. Both of them are rooted in my experience of my smallness. But fear causes me to shrink, while awe opens me to something which is vast. If you've ever stood at the edge of a cliff, then you've danced on the edge. I was a climber for many years. Right, and I have literally hung on rock faces 1,500 feet in the air, and it's awesome and really scary, and the difference between those is whether you trust the situation or not. If you trust the situation, it's just awesome, and if you don't, it's just scary, right? So the sages here are playing with this word. It's a very important word in the Bible, in particular in the Tanakh. If you want, we're not going to do it now, but you should go back and look at the story of the binding of Isaac, where this word plays an extremely important role in its relationship to vision, right? Because ultimately the word awe is a question of what kind of horizon you live in. How small is it? Because it's safer to live in a small horizon, but it's not particularly awesome, right? Right? And you live in an awesome horizon, it's also, listen, anybody here live in mountain country? Right, it's awesome, but that comes with risks, right? I mean, the weather is more extreme, you know, et cetera. You know, this is the nature of life. So here the sages say, look, what used to be the sign of God's awesomeness, awesomitude, his awful deeds, what used to be? No, be specific here in the text. Jeremiah says, foreigners are destroying his temple. Where are his awful deeds? Meaning, Where is his where is his awesomeness? So what was the source of God's awesomitudinous? It was the temple. It was the temple. That was what gave that horizon of the awesome presence of God. It's gone now. Interestingly enough, was it really gone at the time of the second temple?
That's what I understand.
Ah, So just keep that in the back of your mind. But apparently it's gone in Jeremiah. I certainly saw it was gone. What replaces it? In this text, what replaces God's... Remember, God is the point on the horizon that tells you how big your world is. That's how awesome the horizon is. So it used to be that the temple gave you that horizon. What replaces it now? Am Yisrael. The continued survival of the Jewish people. That's what they say, right? Therein lies awesome powers. But for the fear of him, how could one single nation persist amongst the many nations? This is an incredible assertion. Remember, by the way, the easiest answer for why they're ignoring the fact that the Second Temple exists is that this Gemara was written after the Second Temple was destroyed, not after the First. Don't lose sight of that. Also, the sages go out of their way to point out to the Second Temple, though it was a dramatic affair architecturally, spiritually it was empty. Well, empty is perhaps an exaggeration, but it wasn't on the level of the First. But just notice the switch. Where's God's awesome presence in the world now? In you. In the specific survival of the Jewish people. Which, by the way, if you look in the history books, people don't really understand it. It just doesn't really fit any of the historical pictures. The fact that we're sitting here in the rebuilt Jerusalem in the year, call it 5777 or 2017, makes no difference to me, talking about the survival of the Jewish people with a lot of angst, which is good, but at a certain point, you kind of want to say, like, really? You're feeling angsty about our survival? Like, learn some history. It doesn't mean it's all good. It doesn't mean you should sit on your hands. Please don't misunderstand me. But it's awesome.
How many thousands of years did it take to prove it to you?
Yes. And what this Gemara is saying is that God's awe, the fact that God is holding that picture that you can live in a world filled with awe, if you want a point of reference for that, it's Am Yisrael. What about the other Gevura? Where did God's Gevura... You had a question or comment. Where is God's Gevura originally in Daniel? Aliens are enslaving his sons. Where are his mighty deeds?
The mighty deeds, the mighty arm that took the Jews out of the place.
Great. Mighty hand, outstretched arm and mighty hand. You know, if you look in the Tanakh, a Gibur in the Tanakh is what? In the Tanakh. What's a Gibur? David and his mighty men waved their spear over 300 dead. Right? It's a gibur. And by the way, your example is great because, you know, stretching out your hand, gvura, is the ability to assert your will in the world. And so David and his mighty men asserted their will by slaughtering their enemies. God asserts his will in the Torah by bringing one nation out of another. But now you can fill in the blank. For the rabbis, ezu gibur. Right, who's the mighty? The one who conquers their own desire. Notice the resonance back to the earlier part of this Gemara, conquering desire. So it's still an assertion of will. Is it an assertion of will outside of the self? Is it an assertion of will where? Inside the self. So God's Gevura doesn't go away, because now where does it exist? In this Gemara? God's Gevura is no longer taking one nation for another. Where is it?
You handle your own.
What's the text say?
In the people.
No, where is it? In the text, says God's now on the contrary. Right? That he does what? Yeah, solehu. He suppresses his wrath. God's presence is actually shown through his absence. Oh, you think God is gone, say all the enemies of the Jews? Where is your God of the Bible, the angry, vengeful Old Testament God? We say the very fact that you are alive shows how mighty God is. Because if he weren't so mighty, he'd have schmeitzed you long ago. You see how phenomenal that assertion is? First of all, on just a behavioral level. It's like, oh, God's absence is the greatest proof of his might.
This really turns the whole prior knowledge right on its head, and we all believe it.
They just took the entire Bible and turned it over.
Yeah.
You are entirely correct. The further away God gets, the more powerful he is. The more absent God could be, the more present you will find him. Anybody a little bit surprised?
Not more than we are. I'm more surprised if you pulled it off.
Here, and you know why he pulled it off? I'll tell you. There's another source I didn't bring because, of course, there's only so much you can do. But the book of Esther, as we've mentioned a few times, at least those of us who've learned together over the course of the last few days, I said is always, like, always in the background here. Always in the background, in my opinion, is the most beautiful and important book of the entire Tanakh. And there's a question that the Gemara in Yoma asks. Now, Esther is compared to the dawn. There's one of the chapters in the Psalms. It's called Ayelet HaShachar. Right, she's compared to the dawn, and the Gemara asks, why is Esther compared to the dawn? We won't go into why they picked that particular chapter. Do you know the answer? She says, because Esther, Sof Kol HaNisim. Esther is the end of all the miracles. Okay, and just as the dawn comes after the darkness, so too Esther comes after the miracles. That's very nice, isn't it? Except, what does that mean? Miracles are what? Over, but they're also in that metaphor. I'll say it again. Esther's the end of the miracles. Just as Esther comes after all the miracles, so too the dawn comes after the darkness, which means the miracles are darkness. What? The miracles are darkness? What could be a greater indication of the existence of God, which the rabbis were very interested in proving, than a miracle? I mean, splitting the Red Sea, don't know, pretty impressive. Except what happens as soon as the children of Israel go through the Red Sea? Right afterwards, after they sing that song. They start complaining. Yeah? Not just complaining. Hayesh Hashem bekirbeinu im ein. Is God among us or not? You ever find it a little bit strange? The complaining, fine. We all understand complaining, even though it's not okay. Right? But what kind of question is that? Is God with us or not? 10 plagues, splitting of the Red Sea, they are following a pillar of fire. What kind of question is that? You know what kind of question is? Childish one. It's a childish question. Because it's the difference between why my 3-year-old, when I go like this, laughs, and you all look at me like I'm strange. You know, this is called object permanence. It's a very important stage of intellectual, actually it's almost physiological development. Right? What's object permanence? It's the belief that when something isn't seen, it still exists. Infants and small children don't have it. It is a stage of development to know that something exists whether you see it or not. You see where we're going with this? Miracles are darkness because they prevent you from seeing on your own. In the same way, do you see because of the light in this room? Truth is, you don't. You see because of the shadow in this room. Right? If I flooded this room with light right now, I had some giant, you guys all remember when there were flashes on cameras, right? some giant flash right here, and I went, would you see more or less? You'd be blinded by the light. Right? Which is exactly what happened to Israel in the Midbar. They were completely blinded by the miracles to the point where they had no object permanence. God was either saving them in the moment, or they didn't exist, which is the whole theme of the Tanakh. Along come the rabbis and say, we don't want it or its reward. God, you need to back off if this is going to work. And so, therefore, they create a worldview which is reflective of their experience, which says, of course God didn't disappear. That's a deep core belief the sages will not give up on. Where does it come from? It's not just a belief. It's their experience. And I tell you now, that if anybody ever tries to convince you to believe in God, tell them no thank you. If someone tries to help you build a relationship with God, I think it's worth listening to. Right? Yeah?
Why would the sages want to do that?
So that comes back to your question. Because there's a very big difference between my understanding that a small child does actions because there's some like symbolic thing they don't understand. So we say, no, listen, you need to back off and actually understand what you're doing. To me, actually doing an action which is fully representative of the way I see the world, because actions matter. Now, by the way, it's not so clear what's going to happen in that third temple. Let's just remember that, whatever we all may think. But the idea of an intimacy of relationship, right, of having a place to come that we can call home, even though everybody knows God is everywhere, God is bigger than the world. God is the place of the world. The world's not God's place. And all these beautiful statements of the sages. At the same time, you can't have a relationship to an abstraction. This problem doesn't go away. Right? I don't like the idea of my wife. I love my wife. Well, but doesn't that mean like sometimes it doesn't, you don't get along and you don't communicate? Yeah, of course. Well, but wouldn't it be better if your wife were the ideal wife? No. Why not? Because she wouldn't be real. We wouldn't have a relationship. Relationships never happen with the abstract. That's the same way that values don't matter until you're forced to act on them. You know what I call that? It's called the hot lasagna problem. The halacha is concerned with the hot lasagna problem. You guys have heard of this, yes? Right. What's the hot lasagna problem? You can go with my joke for a second. Just imagine that you're walking down the street with a hot lasagna and your pants start to fall down. Whatever you may think about modesty, not wasting food, you're about to decide right now. You got one or two choices. And you may have thought long and hard about not wasting food or not exposing yourself in public, but whatever you thought, you're about to figure out what you actually believe. Right? And that's why I believe the sages were fully committed to a re-embodiment. Embodiment is messy. All organic processes are messy, people. Anything which isn't messy is dead or was never alive to begin with. All organic processes are messy. They're messy. Anybody who has ever been present at a birth knows that organic processes are messy. And that's the sign of life. So they were pretty great in their ability to push God away in order to allow humanity to grow up. And the sages saw this as exactly what God was doing. When we talk about what's called hester panim, the hiding of the face, I don't know if people are familiar with this notion. It starts already in the Torah, this phrase. And the sages, God's hiding his face. Why? Is God hiding his face to punish us? No, God's hiding his face in the same way that if you told your children what to do at every single moment and always made their decisions for them, what would they be for the rest of their lives? Children, you know, like, yeah.
Well, if we had the rebuilding of the third temple, would that be unbelievably problematic? Because basically the rabbinic authorities have to, again, reimagine everything. Because now you're actually seeing God's presence and that mountain just over there. That totally changes everything all over again.
Yes, and in terms of one of the goals of this seminar, of contemplating the parallels between the time of Shivat Zion, of the return to Zion, and the time in which we live today, that is exactly the work that's not being done. You know, it's not being done yet. It's unfair, but there are people, some of them I count amongst my good friends, right, that I call progressive restorationists. They're progressives. They want to move forward. They're not interested in being stuck in the past or simply just a conservative clinging to what was. But they're restorationists. They have a vision that the key to understanding our future is how we tell the story of our past. And you're absolutely correct.
But
in the same,
the land is one thing. Actually having a temple is
a complete another. And being a people, think of all the issues of peoplehood today. Like we were speaking about in the last class, those of us who were there, right? Identity based on religion, identity based on law, identity based on geography, identity based on ideology. Who's a Jew today? Right? These are very messy questions, right? But worth contemplating. Now, we only have a couple minutes left, and there's a whole other element here, which is fine, because I hope you guys got some good learning out of it. But I want to end on this note. Comments or questions about that before we just draw it together in the last 5 minutes? It's not possible that everybody's completely absorbed everything that's going on. I know for a fact. Before we move forward, or anything else, I just don't want to like skip forward. Somebody's got some burning idea they want to share or something which is really unclear. I'd rather spend time on that than just my need to have a neat conclusion. Absolutely. Things that don't change aren't alive. Either they were never alive or they're dead. That's just the way it is. I mean, without any judgments or value, just look at the world. Yeah, I agree with you.
A big chunk of the population in the brainy world, change is not viewed as a good thing.
Okay. I'm aware of that. I deeply disagree with them. I understand why, but I deeply disagree. At the same time, notice, the sages took, and maybe we'll just end on this note, what did they do? They did what's called new wine in old vessels. Meaning, there is a continuity. Yes, it's true, David was a gibor because he swung his spear over 300 dead. And to the sages, to be a gibor wasn't extending my will outside of myself, it was extending my will inside of myself in terms of mastering my desires. Well, the question then for us shouldn't be, this gibor thing is old news, let's think of something new. It's, no, what's a gibor today? I mean, there is a power of continuity which comes with the ability to engage change. And by the way, this is why this whole foundation myth that we've been referencing up until now over and over again, why it's so important. One of the greatest powers of the sages was their ability to present the most radical changes as the most authentic tradition. What's that? Yeah. They're returning things to their origin. By the way, what does the word revolution mean? It means to come back around to where you were. Right? That's what a revolution is. One revolution, two revolution. It's worth thinking about.
So where does, we talked about primeval needs.
Uh-huh.
Where does sacrifice fit into all this?
That's a very big question that I would address in another time. I have a lot to say on that, but not in 3 closing minutes. So, but I would like to take other comments or questions. Just this last piece I think is worth contemplating. There's a whole piece here on prayer, which we're obviously not going to cover in 3 minutes. But it brings us back around to where we started, which was, of course, my intention from the beginning, which is the power of language. Right? The Rambam in particular seems to be really concerned that we pray in Hebrew. And as at least one person pointed out, the Rambam elsewhere says, actually, legally, halakhically speaking, you have to pray in a language that you speak. Right? Prayer is not meant to be some sort of like meaningless sounds that you make in a language you don't understand. It's communication. Prayer as communication has to be in a language that you understand. Otherwise, it's not communication, right? At the same time, why is the Rambam so concerned and the other sources so concerned that there is a liturgy in a specific language? Because I believe that language is only secondarily a tool of communication. Language is primarily a way of understanding one's own experience. It's a frame in which we live. I'll give you an example. I say the word king, and most English speakers picture a guy with a funny hat on a horse and a big seat. I say the word melech, and that may evoke very different associations. Right? Language is a fabric of meaning. And in order to have a conversation as a people, and to keep imagining the ability to take the old and renew, and therefore move forward through time without simply dispersing in exile, right? The power of language and prayer in particular for doing that process of understanding our experience in context of God, whatever that may mean, it didn't mean the same thing to the sages as it did to Moshe, which is fair then to say that it won't mean the same thing to us as it did to them. But language becomes a thread by which we can bind all those people together into one story. Right? So there's endless paths to pursue in the development of the theology of exile. These are just a few of the thoughts. I appreciate your guys' focus and attention, and we are at the end.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.